Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
More than two decades, well, actually, it's when did we, probably about three decades since we've probably been talking about this. South Africa still grappling with its past, and there's a lot of complexity, a lot of emotion around people like Winnie Madikizela Mandela. And there's a new documentary revisiting her life that's apparently on Netflix, and I haven't seen it yet. It's seven parts, and it certainly sounds something that is very, very much worth watching. Tony Leon, I know, was interviewed. He was somewhat involved in it, and we wanted to chat to him just to try and work out in a conversation the complexity of dealing with nuance, because we move further and further away from nuance. Just to spend a minute on social media, nuance is very difficult for us, it would seem, today. But that isn't the reality, and people were complicated, and people who did great things and achieved great things may often weren't so great in other areas of their lives. Tony Leon, former leader of the Democratic Alliance, good morning. Hope you are well.
Good morning, Howard. Yes, no, I'm very well, thank you. And you too, I trust. I think you summed it up very well, the complexity around Winnie Mandela, the paradoxes of her life and career and public times and private life. When I was grappling, well, with her, but, you know, confronting her in Parliament and at the TRC, in the 1990s, I didn't then know, because it wasn't in vogue, the expression, but I intuited and actually wrote about it in my book, on the contrary, two things can be true at the same time. And the one truth, clearly, is Winnie Mandela was a very brave, very resolute, and very determined fighter against apartheid, battling, you know, almost impossible odds, which she overcame, and that is to enormous eternal credit, and that part is reflected. Oh, I haven't seen the whole series. I've watched bits of it in that series. The other part of her, the much darker moon, if you like, in her orbit, was what is also known, and which I confronted mainly because some of the families, Lolo Sono's family, Abubakar Asfat's family, and the family of Dudu Chili, all contacted me when I was dealing with Winnie Mandela in Parliament and said, look, you know, what happened to our families, to our brothers, to our sons is extraordinary and has simply been swept under the carpet. What was very interesting, which is kind of not really explored as I've seen, but I haven't watched all seven parts, so perhaps let me hold this thought, is not that the ANC covered for Winnie, which they did and they didn't. I mean, the Winnie's detractors in the ANC became very prominent afterwards, not least them being Cyril Ramaphosa and Thabo Mbeki. But it wasn't just that there was in the main, a cover-up by the ANC for Winnie's misdeeds, because the ANC in 1994 election had a clear rule: if you've been convicted of a crime, you cannot be a candidate. Well, they waived that for Winnie, and then the whole rule of law itself became problematic. But the truth was as well that the previous regime, the National Party government, certainly signaled by Kwabi Kutsia, the Minister of Justice, under-prosecuted Winnie Mandela. So Stompie Sapai was an impossible case to avoid because it was so prominent. But there were a raft of others which were very carefully chronicled by a journalist called John Collin, who at the time was the Independent from London correspondent here, all of which were either never prosecuted or simply swept aside. And that is because at a certain fundamental point, especially a difficult and fraught moment of transition, the elite looks after its own because there are bigger considerations. So sometimes the quest for justice gets caught up in the need for political reconciliation. And all that, although it's not, I don't think, in this documentary series, was part of the Winnie Mandela story and what it showed us about South Africa as a country that had to bridge two different systems and two different worlds. And Winnie, in a way, was part of that bridge.
In a way, it's almost understandable, because if South Africa were to transition peacefully, which was the goal, there needed to be almost a simplicity around the many aspects of it. And this had the potential, being Mandela's wife, him the icon, had that become part of the national maybe dialogue at the time, there is a chance it could have done damage. And I'm not really, and I'm not even speaking about it legally. I'm even speaking about the fact that I don't know as South Africans if we were in a position to be able to grasp that nuance. I don't know if we are 30 years later. Give me your thoughts on that.
No, I think you've summed up very accurately. Look, on the subject of Nelson and Winnie Mandela and their own highly complex relationship, which the most brilliant book, which is really just, I think, an essential read to understand South Africa, that's Johnny Steinberg's book, Winnie and Nelson, Portrait of a Marriage, which tells you a great deal. But the actual fact is that in 1994, shortly after the election and the first government of national unity, Winnie Mandela was appointed a deputy minister of arts, culture, science, and technology. And Nelson Mandela fired her from the cabinet after a few months because she violated a government order. And many people thought he would never, or she dared him not to fire her, and he duly did. So he acted in furtherance, if you like, of the rule of law. People forget that. And, of course, at the same time, his marriage to her was unraveling. And so I think that's just another layer of complexity. It's almost Shakespearean in the way it played out. And there were two very different South Africas on offer. As the little bit I've seen the documentary, and I need to watch it all, plays. There was the Nelson Mandela Rainbow Nation reconciliation. Let's all do this together. Mm. We one great happy nation family. And then there was a much more populist, much more exclusionary, much more strident South Africa on offer from Winnie Mandela. And it's not for nothing, as they say, that the EFF has named its party headquarters after her. And indeed invokes her name and spirit every time they make an occasion. They would much rather have the Winnie Mandela South Africa than the Nelson Mandela South Africa. So there you have it in one family and one surname, two very different South Africas. And I think the documentary is important for that reason, because it shows you exactly the roots and the complexities of her offer and her life and her contribution, and also does not cover up, and that's where I was interviewed by the late Mandy Jacobson, it does not cover up the misdeeds and the criminality, actually, that happened at her behest with the Mandela United Football Club, which was also part of her legacy.
So I guess the question is are we, as South Africans, too invested in almost like a liberation mythology to confront this kind of uncomfortable truth? Or are we ready as a nation to look back and to deal with this?
Well, imperfect as it was, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which really, bear in mind, made its findings in 1998 or so, actually confronted that, and it did not excuse or exonerate the ANC from its overreach during the liberation struggle, and say that, well, everything, excuse my use of the word, was kosher because we were fighting a just war against a very evil regime. They said, no, you actually have to conform to a basic human rights standard, whatever the justification of your struggle. And that is, incidentally, why And it was very interesting. At the point of publication of the TRC report in late 1998, both Thabo Mbeki on behalf of the ANC and F.W. de Klerk on behalf of himself went to court to try and stop the publication of the TRC report, which Desmond Tutu, of course, was the chairman of. And it was Nelson Mandela, in the last year of his presidency, who basically said, publish and be damned. So even the trying to record, however incompletely the TRC did it, the complexities of the struggle and the system against which the struggle was launched caused a lot of division. But the president of the day stood up for the what was perceived to be the truth in that report. And that's another interesting factor that sometimes wished away or just forgotten about.
What I actually find interesting, as and I'm just thinking about it as you're talking about it, is to some extent the very few of our politicians and especially the those involved from the ANC side that we can look at with any form of nuance and almost see the different aspects of it. Winnie Mandela actually is one of those. None of this that we're talking about is really unknown to us. But if you start looking across the board at the others involved, there's very little that we do know about who they really were.
Well, there are very few people around from that time as well. That's the other thing. Mm. I have, just because I've got a column coming out today in News 24 on the topic. You know, on Monday we celebrated or ignored very few people seem to be invested in it. Freedom Day, which is the commemoration of the 27 April election, 1994. I did a little count with assistance from Courtney Mulder, who's one of the few survivors of that 1994 parliament. I think there are seven MPs in Parliament today who were around in 1994, plus Cyril Ramaphosa, who's no longer an MP but certainly was around in 1994. The rest of them have moved on or died. So the actual act of commemoration, or indeed the background that people have, whether it's complex or not, simply doesn't exist. And what you've got today, and this is not just in South Africa, is basically a cohort of people in Parliament across most parties who know no other careers except politics. They're city councillors who become MPs, they're mayors who transition to become ministers. But there are very few people who have a hinterland from the complex days of struggle, because they're either too old, they've retired, or they've died. So actually, if you look in and interrogate most of our political operatives and leading figures today, they don't really have a background of very much at all, and certainly weren't part of all the difficulties and all the challenges and all the triumphs of the transition from apartheid to democracy, and therefore they weren't really involved in a struggle or anything else at all except profession in politics itself.
Should we be looking at more of our historical figures in the same way?
Yes, absolutely. Look, I think, let me very immodestly say, in my book that came out last year, being there, I looked at three icons of that period, F.W. de Klerk, Nelson Mandela, and Mangosuthu Buthelezi, precisely because of the complexity and contradiction of their lives and their careers, which I think actually led to a lot of very useful outcomes. So if you're just one thing, if you only have one thing in your resume that, you know, you were part of a heroic struggle, but actually you ignore the darker side of it, you actually have much less of a joined up human being.
Absolutely.
And I think that you need to look at people in the whole, in the round, as it were. And that actually makes for a much more useful analysis than simply saying, having a binary approach, you know, they're either good or bad, they were either in favor of democracy or against it. Most human beings, and therefore most politicians, since, believe it or not, all politicians are human beings,
doesn't
always seem like that, you know, do have a complexity. They have a dark side.
And so much more interesting. It is so much more interesting and relatable when they do. That's why I can hardly read some of these business success books, because they're just boring. It's you know, it's they become like LinkedIn profiles rather than a study of human nature.
May I go completely off topic?
Yes.
Because I'm speaking to you and you have a specific audience. But it is talking about of interest.
Sure.
What to me is of current interest is I was present last night at UCT at the extraordinarily good and brave lecture of Adam Mendelsohn, his inaugural lecture as a professor of history. And really, it is something worth reflecting on for members of this community.
Oh, please share that with us. Tell us about
well, it. You know, well, he obviously can speak with much more expertise himself, but it was really what it means to be a Jew in South Africa today.
Wow.
And what the future is. And it was just an excellent lecture. It was historically fascinating. It was contemporary. It was said in the presence, and it's important they were there, of the Vice Chancellor, the Deputy Vice Chancellor, and the Dean of Humanities at UCT, who were on the platform. And he really said, you know, UCT is no longer a welcoming place for Jews, and here's why. And South Africa also has some very interesting perspectives. And there was a very interesting counterpoint offered by the discussant of the lecture, Professor Bilschitz of the University of Johannesburg in Oxford, who reprised something that I said many years ago to the Cape Board of Jewish Board of Deputies, that actually to be Jewish in South Africa, you don't need a permission slip, which goes to your first points when you were taking on one of your callers about why one should go to Israel, that you are a constitutional citizen with inalienable rights here, and you need to exercise them. And it was a fascinating dialogue between the two of them, largely in agreement, but with some points of differentiation. So I think actually it's a very, very important milestone for this community, that lecture.
In fact, we'll definitely reach out to him to have a conversation with him about that. Tony Leon, thank you as always, former leader of the Democratic Alliance.